Okay, so now we've picked apart a case where the patient presents with resectable disease. Let's get into the issue of conversion to resectability. Steve?
This is a 42-year-old man who, busy with work, had several young children, some intermittent rectal bleeding, thought it was hemorrhoids, getting progressively more tired, losing weight, and finally decided to seek medical attention. During his workup, heme-positive stools, his liver edge was down 4 or 5 centimeters, a little bit anemic, mild elevation of liver enzymes, colonoscopy, large non-obstructing mass in the sigmoid colon, biopsy of that showed it to be adenocarcinoma, and on the CT scan had large and multiple liver metastases involving both lobes of the liver. Given their size, the number, and potentially location, certainly raised concern if this is resectable.
What do you think about that, Chan?
Yeah, I think this description is good. I mean, he's got both lobes of the liver involved, large one, maybe about 10 centimeters in the right lobe. He's also got one on the left lobe that we see a bit of and a big lesion occupying much of segment 4. So certainly bilobar, certainly big.
What about the issue, Fergus, of potential encroachment, compromising margins?
The segment 4 lesion is pretty close to the porta hepata, so there seems to be a preserved fat plane. So one would certainly want to interrogate the other images to see exactly its relationship to critical structures. And Steve, you might want to speak to that too, I guess, is what's important to you surgically.
Yeah, well, the key here is he's got almost every segment of the liver involved. I don't see anything in segment 1, and he's got a segment 2 lesion, which may be extending down to segment 3. So, again, you'd have to say he doesn't really meet the criteria for having 2 uninvolved segments. And plus, his left lateral bisegment, segments 2 and 3, are quite small. Even if he didn't have that lesion there in segment 2, if you did an extended right hepatectomy in this guy, margin on the portal vein and on the hepatic veins would be close, and I'm not sure you'd leave him with enough. So, again, he's a guy who you'd have to really get some downsizing of these lesions and maybe consider a portal vein embolization even.
So, Mike, can you talk a little bit about the volumetric issues? We talked a little bit about it, but maybe, again, more basic in terms of how you think that through.
So that would be in an area where the portion of the remnant liver, the portion of the liver that will remain where it's cancer-free, good inflow, good outflow, good biliary drainage, but the volume, there's concern that the remnant volume is insufficient to sustain liver function and to adequately regenerate after surgery. If there's any concern for that, that's where the volumetrics could be done. And if it's insufficiently low, if it's too low, then there are a variety of approaches, two main approaches to try to overcome that. One is portal vein embolization of the side to be removed, or in this case, you could do segment 4 plus the right liver in some cases. And that then elicits hypertrophy of that remnant liver to a size in which it would be safe then to resect the rest. The other approach we sometimes use in the case where there's remnant uninvolved liver but it's too small is to do a staged liver resection, where typically what we do is do the smaller, the sublobar resection first, perhaps combine then with portal vein ligation or portal vein embolization at the first operation. Hypertrophy of what was left behind of that left liver, let's say, and then resect as a second operation. In this case, the left lateral sector is involved with a big metastasis. The left medial sector has something. The right has got big-time disease. So this would not be someone we would do liver volumetrics on the get-go. I would put, though, this patient in the potentially convertible category, but needs a pretty significant response.
Now, when you do the portal vein embolization, how long do you wait, John? How long does it take for it to regrow, and what's the timing and what goes on during that time?
I think the best data is actually from Steve's unit, I think, isn't it? And my recollection is that you get most after 4 weeks, and after 2 months, there's not much else you get. I think that would be right, would it, Steve?
Correct.
That's what you
see. You see your maximal hypertrophy in the first 4 to 5 weeks. We routinely do a scan 4 weeks after portal vein embolization to, again, do another volumetric scan. So if I ask Chan to do a volumetric scan, and let's say the left lateral bisegment is 16% of the total liver volume, we then do the portal vein embolization, and we want to see that come up somewhere in the 25 to 30% range, and it generally only takes 4 to 5 weeks for that to happen.
Is there any anti-tumor effect of portal vein embolization?
No, there's no anti-tumor effect because, again, metastases get their blood supply from the hepatic artery, particularly when they're large like this. There is always a theoretical concern with doing this, which is you are essentially causing the liver to hypertrophy and releasing growth factors much as you would do after a resection. There are the occasional patients who, after portal vein embolization, will actually show significant progression of their metastatic disease in the liver. Again, presumably related to the release of growth factors. Again, could that just be the biology of their disease? We don't know. But we've all seen that happen. We've actually, in our experience at Anderson, we've now, for colorectal metastases, done probably about 220 portal vein embolizations. I think we've had 6 patients show significant progression of their disease in that 4-week interval.
So, Alan, in terms of this issue of, quote, conversion in a patient like this, what are you looking for to pull away from critical structures, to make tumors go away? I mean, what are you trying to achieve?
So in this case, clearly, this is number and geography. So you'd need a major reduction of some of these tumors to be confident that you could get a margin. In this patient, I think the likelier scenario is also where's the other sites of disease? Because this is large volume disease. I would tell this patient, I doubt that you could be cured, but it's not out of the question. And to me, the course of therapy is, I would say, you need a really robust response. And this is a patient I would throw the book at. 40-ish?
42.
Yeah, so I would throw the book at, I would be very aggressive in treating him, but realistic.
With what?
Well, so certainly a chemotherapeutic backbone with a biologic. Is this a patient to use FOLFOXIRI? I don't know, but this is a patient I would be quite aggressive on.
Axel, a patient like this a couple years ago, maybe in a situation like this, people might have raised the issue of combined antibodies with chemo. Can you kind of update us on what we've learned in the last couple of years about that?
Yeah, in some ways, it always sounded so great. We have two antibodies that work to biologic principles, and we just throw them together, and sometimes things don't work as well as we thought. And actually, now we have 3 trials, the 2 PACE trials, which I consider 2 trials, 1 oxaliplatin-based, 1 irinotecan-based.
That was panitumumab.
That was panitumumab plus in a bevacizumab background. And the CAIRO-2 trial, which looked at capecitabine oxaliplatin plus bevacizumab as backbone, deleting oxaliplatin from the treatment routinely after 6 cycles in an Optimox-like regimen. So we're really talking about 5-FU bevacizumab or capecitabine bevacizumab backbone. That the addition of cetuximab did not help and might actually be detrimental in its outcome to some patients.
Now, which of these studies have looked at KRAS at this point, and did that help?
All of these studies have looked at KRAS. Some of the data are not yet published. The CAIRO-2 trial, I think, has the most solid foundation in terms of what we know about KRAS. Unfortunately, the investigators, when they presented the data at ASCO, they had just received the KRAS data 4 days before the presentation, so there's not a lot of tweaking and looking at subgroups and who might have benefited and whatever. And KRAS is not the only story that we need to keep in mind when we talk about cetuximab. But from the data we have seen in KRAS wild-type tumors, which we think are more responsive or are the ones that are responsive to cetuximab in theory, the addition of cetuximab didn't provide any additional benefit. So it kind of, whatever benefit could have been added when cetuximab was used in wild-type KRAS tumors was somehow taken away by this presumed negative interaction with bevacizumab. So there was no detrimental effect, but no gain.
Rich, what's your take on, I mean, to me, looking at this from the outside, I was kind of surprised that these trials didn't show something positive. What do you think is going on?
Well, I think it's the biology again. The biology is more complicated than we understand. You know, we thought, oh, VEGF inhibition and EGFR inhibition will work better together than alone, in part because of the BOND-2 trial, where it looked like they did in the advanced disease setting, and in part because we thought, well, you know, here's 2 chinks in the armor that we can exploit with biologics in addition to chemotherapy. But I think that upregulating one thing and downregulating another may cause the balloon to bulge in ways that we don't expect. And I believe that that may have been what happened here.
What about choice of chemotherapy, either irinotecan, oxali, or combined, as Alan was alluding to?
Yes, yes, and yes.
What do you think you likely would do in a situation like that?
In this situation, I would add to Alan's considerations of size and geography to say biology. And I don't know when the biology changes, what's the crux point is. You know, there's no argument about one met. The biology of that is relatively indolent, and surgical resection to achieve logs of cell kill is indicated. You know, I stood on the podium with a Japanese surgeon who showed this elegant operation where he resected 17 liver mets in a patient. And I thought it was a surgical tour de force and an oncologic waste of time. Where is equipoise? Is it 6 lesions, 8 lesions? Is it 30% of liver or 50% of liver? I don't know. But this is a case where I would want to be sure that I could control the biology of the disease by using chemotherapy before taking this patient to the OR, and I would use either FOLFOX-BEV or FOLFIRI-BEV in this situation.
Even in wild-type KRAS?
Well, you know, I don't think we really know what that means for a patient like this. Yes, the response rates in the OPUS trial looked good for cetuximab, but it's a pretty small trial. It's a retrospective analysis. Do we know that in wild-type KRAS, cetuximab is going to be better than bevacizumab? We don't yet, but 80405 will tell us, and it's amended
reopening.
Form.
That's reopening in the next week or two.
Can you just update us on what that study is looking at and what happened?
Right. So
initially, you're the PI of?
It's a three-arm study that took all comers untreated with metastatic colorectal cancer, physician-patient choice of FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, with a randomization to bevacizumab, cetuximab, or the combination of bevacizumab, cetuximab. It accrued 1,474 patients, at which point it became clear with a drip, drip, drip of data on KRAS that there was a subset of patients who certainly didn't benefit from cetuximab. So the study was closed, as were all studies with the EGFR inhibitor. Steve's study was closed as well, the adjuvant study, and amended. Now, for my study, there were two questions. One was excluding KRAS mutant patients, and so an amendment. Patients are registered, KRAS status is ascertained, and those who are mutant come off the study. Wild-type patients stay. The issue was whether a two-arm randomization or the three arms, including the two biologics, was appropriate. So in that regard, Rich and I actually presented a series of data to our data safety monitoring board, who looked at the data we had, not KRAS stratified. So we do not have KRAS data, but they looked at the data set and were of the opinion that there was no reason to close, to not continue the double biologic arm. So it will reopen with three arms. And it was just approved by Central IRB 2 weeks ago, so it should reopen any day.
Now, do you look prospectively at whether or not, as part of this trial, this is an attempt to convert a patient? Do you gather those data?
Right. So this is a trial. For example, one of the eligibility documents is what is the goal of therapy? So is the goal curative or not? And although it's very hard to legislate, we are collecting data on patients who go to surgery and what their ultimate outcome is, including surgical morbidity as well as long-term outcome. The interesting thing is, based on the early data, it appears that between a quarter and a third of patients are going to surgery.
Wow.
Now, some of this is our synchronous patients who are going to surgery for their primaries. So it's a little hard to tease out, but it looks like as many as a third of patients come off study because of surgery.
But when you ask, is the goal cure?
As of an early look, it was about 30% were deemed cure. And what we haven't been able to do is analyze, is there a difference between the academic centers and the community centers in terms of who they think is curable and who isn't?
Interesting.